Hi, welcome. I'm Rick Barton, the co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project with Karen von Hippel. We're here as co-moderators, although there's really not that big a job, so she's asked if I would do most of it. So if I start to flag, she'll jump in. But thank you. It's good to see a number of familiar faces who've worked a great deal on this issue on Pakistan over the years, and so thank you. And also, many people who seem to be coming to it more recently. I'd like to thank Craig Cohen, who's here in the back row from our Chief of Staff office, for suggesting this program and having heard our speakers and read their work in other places. And I think that Ambassador Tezi Schaefer will be with us before long as well. Karen and I are just back from 2 weeks where we traveled through various parts of Pakistan, and we've left you a copy of our trip report, so we won't go over it at this point, but I hope that you'll have a chance to look at it and get back to us with your thoughts and comments, because as we all know, it's an incredibly dynamic situation. Virtually every hour there's some political development that means something, and so we'd welcome your insights and your feedback. What we wanted to do today was to just get the voices of a younger generation of analysts and experts who have recently lived in the country and spent considerable time there. And so we're really lucky to have Nick Schmidl and Josh White here. I think that their biographies are in front of you or you've all received them, so I really won't go through that. But they're doing some interesting work, and each of them will speak for about 15 minutes, and then we'll have a chance to have about a one-hour discussion. So I think Josh will go first, and it's great to have you here. Thanks for making the time, and thanks for your good work in the field as well over the last few years. So, Josh.
Thanks so much. It's good to be here, and I'd like to thank Rick and Karen for having us. It seems like it's almost an axiom of Washington these days that you can plan a Pakistan event a couple weeks in advance and pretty much be certain that something very significant is going to happen just a day or two beforehand, which will make it perhaps all the more interesting. So sure enough, a few days ago, there's some real changes at the coalitional level in the government. And I want to begin by talking about some of those macro politics and then go drill down a little bit and speak about the frontier and what we see with governance in the frontier and some of the ideas that have been put forward by the new government to deal with the overall security situation that they're facing. I think the macro politics are important, and I'll explain why in a moment. But for those of you who haven't been obsessively reading the Pakistani news, the short version of what has happened is that Nawaz Sharif decided to leave the cabinet but remain in Pakistan's coalition. He's going to stay on the treasury benches, and his party is going to remain in the majority in the Punjab province, in the Punjab Assembly. And his brother Shahbaz Sharif is the presumptive chief minister of the Punjab province if his nomination papers are approved by the Musharraf affiliated in some ways election commission. And I think that on the face of it, one can easily explain what the issue was which caused this falling out. It was an issue about the judges, which is somewhat complex, but essentially on November 3rd, with the imposition of the emergency, two things happened. About 60 judges were sacked, and simultaneously, a number of new judges were brought in under the PCO, the Provisional Constitutional Order. And so the debate is about both sets of those judges, the ones who were sacked, how they're going to come back, if they're going to come back, if the Chief Justice, Iftikhar Chaudhry, is going to come back, and about the ones who were brought in under the PCO, which some people think was unconstitutional. So there have been agreements made between Nawaz Sharif and Zardari and then extended, and the discussion kind of fell apart. I think there are two important underlying factors behind what's happening and kind of why it matters. The first is that in a very kind of obvious political way, the PPP and Asif Zardari have a real interest in seeing Musharraf stay around, and Nawaz Sharif doesn't. And also, the PPP is concerned that if some of these judges come back, the ones who were sacked, that could have negative implications on some of the amnesties that had been granted to the PPP in the past. So there's a whole kind of web of political considerations. And a lot of it comes down to this debate over whether a constitutional amendment or a constitutional package is required in order to bring back a set of judges or in order to make the PCO judges official. And this is actually a very interesting debate because it not only is there a debate about the constitutionality of an amendment, but in fact there's a very curious situation now in which in theory, the coalition has enough votes to impeach Musharraf if they wanted to, if they were able to round up enough people. But they don't have enough votes to pass a constitutional amendment. And that's because both require two-thirds, but they require different two-thirds. To impeach, you need two-thirds of the aggregate of both of the houses. And to pass a constitutional amendment, you need two-thirds of each of the houses. And the Senate is still on Musharraf's side. So all of this drama to say that there are some real debates about the issue of what needs to happen constitutionally to move forward, and essentially how Nawaz Sharif can save face with his base, with his coalition, because he ran on this issue of the judges. So that's kind of the overall political factor. Second, I think there's a factor which has been largely ignored, which is the underlying political economic realities. The economic situation in Pakistan is politically rather dangerous right now for a lot of the major players. The pre-election polling showed that economic issues ranked higher than militancy and everything else in terms of voter concerns. And Pakistan has seen double-digit food inflation recently. You can't read the media and not see reports about how high food prices are going and some of the staple foods. And the government has really no choice politically but to institute food subsidies in a really major way. That wouldn't be so much of a problem if the government had some fiscal space to be able to deal with that, but the fact is that they really don't. They're running a large current account deficit. They have dual deficits. They're really in a tough fiscal situation. And so what this is going to require is that they're going to have to make a lot of trade-offs in the coming 6 to 12 months. They're going to have to cut a lot of development spending. And the rupee is depreciating because there's some capital flight to the UAE and concerns about Pakistan's growth. And so all of this comes back to the fact that in order to deal with their pressing political problem, they're going to have to make some difficult decisions in terms of their economic program. There are also very high food prices, oil prices. And this raises another problem for the government, and that is that with their currency depreciating, they need to be able to defend the rupee, and they need more foreign reserves. And so they're going around hat in hand to Washington trying to get $3 or $4 billion more in foreign reserves. And the international community seems to be saying, well, that's fine, but you, as a condition, you have to pass along oil prices to consumers. So what we're going to be seeing, I think, is a really interesting scenario over the next 6 to 12 months. Imagine you're Nawaz Sharif or Shahbaz Sharif or the finance minister, and you're looking out 6 to 12 months as being part of this coalition. The best case scenario, realistic best case scenario that you could hope for, is that food inflation has decelerated but is still a major political issue, that oil prices have continued to go up as the government's been forced to pass along those prices to consumers, and that the development funding has been cut, particularly over the averages we've seen over the last 5 years. That's your realistic best case scenario. And then add to that the fact that as the PMLN, the cabinet offices that you hold happen to be finance, food, commerce, and petroleum. I would call it a trifecta, but there are four. So, I mean, that's really a killer political situation as they're looking out over the next few months. And that's something that's really come to light more and more over the last 3 months since the elections, and I think has to be weighing very heavily on their mind. So Nawaz Sharif's calculus, I think, is that he wants to stay enough inside the coalition to prevent the PVP from joining up with Musharraf in a very serious way. And he wants to stay enough outside the coalition that he can deflect criticism when it comes to these economic issues, which are very evidently coming down the pike. And some might say, well, this is kind of his last ditch plan B. But in many ways, this looks a lot like what Nawaz Sharif's plan A used to be right after the election, when he was really seeking to try to stay outside of the cabinet in many ways so that he wouldn't take the blame for anything that happened and to consolidate his power in the Punjab. So this isn't a terrible situation for him, and in many ways, it gives him an opportunity to build up his own base. All of this is important for the U.S., I think, because in spite of the U.S.'s concerns about Nawaz Sharif, the stability of this coalition is really important. And if the U.S. cares about seeing a long-term agenda against extremism on the part of the Pakistani government, then it should care about the longevity of this coalition and of coalitional politics and of giving that kind of politics enough space to be able to reassert control over civilian institutions. And if it cares about that, then it should care about ensuring that this government is able to deal with the fiscal problems and the economic problems that are going to be coming very quickly. So that's kind of the big picture of I think some of what's happening at the macro level, and I just want to zoom down to the frontier level, which I think there are some really fascinating things happening there. All of you saw after the elections that the ANP had a very strong showing in the elections, even stronger than ANP insiders were predicting. They were surprised at how well they did in a number of parts of the frontier. There was a lot of news about kind of the triumph of the moderates and the ouster of the MMA, the Islamic parties. And I think that was right on in a lot of ways, but I wouldn't read too much into it because politics is highly cyclical on the frontier, and the incumbents almost always lose, unlike Washington, where they almost always win. The ANP has also put out a really ambitious agenda, which I want to talk about in just a moment, which is something that should be of great interest to the United States as it looks at the frontier. But let me say, first of all, I think it's important to outline some of the weaknesses, some of the strengths and weaknesses of the ANP vis-a-vis the former coalition. There's been a lot of emphasis on its strengths, but I think a balanced picture would show that the ANP, these are the Pashtun nationalists who used to be really dominant in the frontier over the years and came back with a very strong showing, they bring a lot of technocratic skills to the table. The ANP is full of lawyers and people who have been involved in development and in the bureaucracy, and they really have a very impressive skill set, and they're very much oriented to dealing with structural issues. If you talk with them, they think in terms of structural issues much more than the Islamic government, the previous Islamic government, for example. They bring a sort of middle-class sensibility about them. They are secular, not in an American sense, but kind of in a South Asian sense in terms of treating all religions kind of more of a welcoming posture and not wanting to see too much Islamic politics come into actual governance. They're pro-Karzai, which makes the U.S. happy, and they're serious about dealing with extremism. And I would argue that they're kind of pan-Pashtun outlook. The fact that they don't give much consideration to the Durand Line, which divides Pakistan and Afghanistan, is actually very helpful as a means of neutralizing any kind of pan-Pashtun problems. I think actually by bringing it to the forefront, they've talked about changing the name of the province to Pakhtunistan or Pakhtunkhwa. These kind of things will actually, I think, help to neutralize any pan-Pashtun sentiment. So there's a lot that they bring to the table which is very positive and which the U.S. has been excited about. Some of the things that are I think, on the negative side of the ledger is that historically the party is very fragmented. Lots of problems in family politics and fragmentation for decades. That seems to be in check at the moment. They seem quite excited that they're in power, and it doesn't seem to have caused any deep rifts yet. Their base is the Peshawar Valley, the areas around Peshawar, the agricultural areas. And so as a result, I would expect them to focus on those areas which have traditionally been the focus of governments sitting in Peshawar. And to an extent, there's nothing quite negative about that, except that the previous government did direct a lot of development funding to some of the far-flung areas, which had received less development funding in previous cycles. And so one thing to watch is how strong of a home bias there is on the part of this government toward the areas which are already somewhat more developed. The fact that the ANP is pro-Karzai makes the U.S. happy to some extent, but it also makes them quite unpopular among a lot of Pashtuns. I think Nicholas could probably speak to this. It's hard to travel in the frontier and find many people at all who like Hamid Karzai in the Northwest Frontier Province. Many people say that he's a fake Pashtun. That's kind of the line that you get. And so the ANP has really tried to kind of tone down their pro-Karzai orientation during and since the election, but it's very much there. And I think to sum up the negative side, given their secular orientation and their pro-Karzai orientation, they're really politically vulnerable on their right flank, you could say. And I think this is also something to watch, both from the Islamists in terms of religious issues, from PMLN, even though they're not as strong in the frontier, and because of their ties with Karzai, which is deeply unpopular in the frontier, that really affects how they see political threats in their own area, and it's going to affect how they deal with carrying out peace deals, with making concessions, with dealing with Sharia legislation, which is proposed. A whole range of things are going to be driven by that domestic political calculus on their part. The ANP government has thrown out this whole number of ideas on in terms of what to do to address the security problems in the frontier. The chief minister, in his inaugural address on April 10th, put out a number of ideas about creating an elite police force of 7,500 strong, which would be kind of a quick response police force to deal with militancy within the province proper, which I think is probably quite a good idea. Beginning to try and replace some of the army presence with police and frontier corps forces, which might work better in terms of public opinion. He's had some creative ideas about leveraging citizen kind of community organizations, which function for service delivery and development, also trying to leverage them for security purposes and creating kind of local peace councils all throughout the province and creating peace boards and addressing some of the structural issues which have made it difficult for the government to respond decisively to Talibanization. Issues of policing, issues of the relationship between civil administrators and the police at very local levels, stuff which kind of would make your eyes glaze over, except that on a local level, it's had a profound impact on the ability of the government to respond decisively when guys in white pickups with Kalashnikovs calling themselves the Taliban roll into a little village somewhere. So there are a lot of ideas that are being put forward by the ANP to think structurally about how they can address some of the problems in the frontier. There's also been a proposal by Khaled Aziz, who's a former chief secretary in the province, who's kind of now advising the ANP, which is an even more ambitious kind of proposal, which is floating out there, of a package of $4 billion over 3 years that they would like to see, which would include a little bit of everything, or in fact, a lot of everything, livelihoods, education, job creation, madrasa reforms, a whole number of things. And then Khaled Aziz in particular has put forward some good ideas, as well as other folks within the ANP, about what to do about the Fatah in a structural sense. The ANP's preference tends to be, their bias tends to be, to bring the tribal areas into the Northwest Frontier Province, to find some way to integrate them. This would serve their political advantage, and so they think it's a very fine idea. And they've been talking about it for a while, and there's something to commend the idea. But they've been putting forward the ideas about the structural reform, about what to do about the frontier crimes regulation. Do you allow for judicial review to the decisions which are carried out by the administrator? Do you create elections at the local government level? There are a whole just array of questions that one needs to answer when you talk about governance reform in the tribal areas. What are you moving that reform toward? What does the system look like? And they come up with some creative ideas which we can talk about more. Some of these ideas I think are problematic on the merits. $4 billion over 3 years would be a 50% increase in the size of the provincial budget, which I think is unsustainable. And some of the questions about the Fatah, I have differing opinions, but they're really coming up with a lot of ideas, and they're kind of in this phase right now of coming up with lots of ideas and are going to be moving to the implementation stage. When they do move to the implementation stage, I think we're going to see a lot of this happen in piecemeal. The ideas are coming largely from the ANP, but I think the projects which are actually chosen, that's going to be determined by what the donor community decides they're going to fund. Given Pakistan's fiscal situation, they're certainly not in a position to be able to put out a lot more money either in the way of fiscal transfers from Islamabad to Peshawar or in terms of large national-level development projects. So I think a lot of it's going to come down to what the international community thinks among this kind of this potpourri of ideas might be worth funding, those projects which meet, which kind of appeal to the joint interests. And there are a number of things which I think would, from policing to governance reform. If it were up to me, some of the things that I would probably highlight or focus on would be dealing with the police, trying to improve investigative capacity, a rapid response on the part of the police, and the relation between the police and the civil authority, which has been so complex that it has gotten bogged down and hasn't allowed the government to respond to Talibanization. I saw the other day that USAID is thinking of putting more money into dealing with courts and justice issues. I think that could have a really strong impact because a lot of the complaints that come from areas like Swat and elsewhere, the Swat Valley, is that the civil court system is so slow, so antiquated, everything takes forever, and so when somebody comes along and says, well, I'll give you Sharia law in an hour, it's very appealing. So those kind of things are important. And I think any issue which really brings together the question of development in the tribal areas, which is on the minds of everyone here in Washington, and governance in the tribal areas would be tremendously valuable. I feel like we focus very much on development. Who's getting money? What are we giving money to? And rather less on exactly what kind of structure is in place to distribute that money. Are we reifying an existing system? How can we come with that money in a way that moves the governance forward? And let me just close, and then I'll pass it over to Nicholas. I think one of the final things that's really interesting that the government is doing in the frontier is initiating some peace deals. And in the frontier, the frontier government is particularly focused on Swat and on Deir al-Mukhail, just south of Peshawar. And these deals are all a little bit different, and the environments are different between Swat. I'm somewhat more optimistic that a Swat peace deal could work in some sense, probably not right away, probably not as nicely as we would like, but I'm somewhat optimistic that it could be really helpful. I'm somewhat less optimistic about Waziristan, and places like Deir al-Mukhail probably fall somewhere in between. But my broader point, I think, as I look at what this new government is trying to do, and it's just begun some peace deals, which usually begin with ceasefires and then turn into kind of a first phase of a deal and then go through negotiations. In general, I think that these deals can really have a lot of value even if they fail. And that is because if you look at the trade-off of what these deals provide, on the negative side, they certainly do allow these groups to kind of regroup and get some breathing room, which has always been a concern of the U.S. Of course, these groups are usually kind of set their own schedules for being on the offensive anyway. But it does give them some time to regroup. But I think in a much more fundamental way, it helps to shift public opinion in a useful direction. And we talk a lot in Washington about wanting to see the Pakistanis come to own the problem that they face, the problem which is in their own backyard. And I think one of the ways that Pakistanis come to own the problem is when they see that their own government is trying to do deals. Those deals might succeed, but even if they fail, then the people see, well, you know, our government, they gave it a good shot, but these folks who are calling themselves righteous Taliban in these areas are really being intransigent. I don't understand what's going on here. It really reframes the conversation from a political perspective. From Washington, I think these kind of deals look, the optics are, they look just like the failed deals that happened in Waziristan a few years ago. And in some substantive ways, there are some real similarities. But from the optics of somebody sitting in the frontier, from a Pashtun living in the frontier, these deals look entirely different from the ones that took place a few years ago. And so I think we have to analyze them from the substantive perspective, but also from this optical public opinion kind of perspective. They look different because they're being conducted by a government which people think is more legitimate, a government which was elected, a government which has made all of the noises of having the public interest in mind in a way and kind of framing things in a way that Musharraf never did. So those optics are important. And certainly with these deals, there's a kind of dramatic staged quality to how they play out. And a lot of it is, in fact, just that. But I think that, and I'll close with this, if the United States wants to be able to see in the near term or the midterm, to see Pakistan and its government undertake more invasive and more kinetic kinds of responses to militancy and not see a lot of blowback from that, I think we have to let some of these deals play out. Because in letting them play out, it builds the idea among the population that maybe there is a real threat which is endogenous and not just something that is in Pakistan because there's a Musharraf who's linked to America, who's bringing a foreign kind of agenda. So for that reason, I think it's important at this stage for the U.S. to be patient. And even though this is in the early stages, from everything that I've seen so far, I think my opinion is that the government is playing its hand very well with these negotiations. That's not to say I think they're all going to succeed in our sense, in our frame of seeing it, but I think it's playing its hand well. It's doing what it has to do politically, and it could really bear some fruit down the line.
Can you hear me?
All right. I'm gonna sort of pick up this conversation from the standpoint of how this is all playing out and how this is looking from the ground level in amongst these Taliban and in the Northwest Frontier Province, and discuss why these deals are destined to fail, why these deals can never work, and secondly, what exactly it is that the militants want and what ultimately will appease them. I think that Josh brings up certainly a number of very valid points, and I think that it kind of reflects, if you will let me sort of use a little bit of foreign policy jargon, a constructivist versus a realist standpoint here. I'm going to, though, take a bit more of a realist standpoint and explain the difficulties in them. The problem is that the peace deals can't work because there are too many parties that are at odds with one another whose goals are inherently at odds with one another. This isn't just the Pakistanis and the militants who are signing these deals. It's the Pakistani government, it's the militants, it's the Americans on the other side, and it's the Afghan government. And in the Pakistani government, I don't think that anyone is too naive to realize that these deals, that all four parties are not involved in the building of these deals, but I think that we should lay that out there. First of all, what are the goals of the government? The February election gave a mandate to this new government to do something different than it had been. Musharraf's political decisions over the preceding 7 years, but particularly over the preceding 2 years and punctuated by the Red Mosque operation, were seen as being dictated by Washington. And although no ordinary Pakistani, and this I think is a fascinating point, no ordinary Pakistani will ever themselves go to the tribal areas. They're scared, you know what-less of the tribal areas. Of those people. And yet they lionize those people because the tribals have stood up against imperial powers, the British, you know, everyone dating back three millennium almost. So that's, I think, a very worthwhile point to note, in that because these people have stood up again, because the tribals have fought against Musharraf's government, because the tribals have fought against the Americans, they are regarded as heroes. Now, What you saw was that Pakistanis were unhappy. People were dying in the streets, increasingly in the tribal areas, increasingly in the cities. And the 2008 election should very much be seen as almost akin to the 06 election in the United States was very much a referendum against the way that Bush was handling the war. And the 08 election in Pakistan was very much a referendum against the way that Musharraf was handling the war. So the government had to do something. The ANP, as Josh mentioned, this Awami National Party, this Pashtun Nationalist Party, do believe in dialogue. And what they wanted to try and do was to take the debate from the mosques, where in the traditional mosque structure you had one mullah standing at the front of the crowd, lecturing them and telling them the way things were. And they wanted to take that debate from the mosque, and they wanted to bring it into the hujra. And the hujra is kind of a meeting room, a traditional place in each Pashtun home, at the front of the home where guests come, and they sit there and they sit for literally hours drinking tea and just chit-chatting and engaging in political discussion. And this was their idea, was to kind of transfer where this dialogue was taking place. The problem that I found was that the culture of the frontier province since the ANP had last been in power had changed dramatically, not irrevocably, but had changed dramatically. and that the traditional authority structures that the ANP built its trust on, that is, negotiating through the jirga, through the hujra, through the tribal elders, had been sidelined in favor of this sort of new generation of young militants. Let's look at an example of Baitullah Masood. Baitullah Masood is the one most of you probably heard of, who is the government accuses of masterminding Benazir Bhutto's assassination. Baitullah Masood in the press is often described as being a tribal chieftain, particularly in the Western press. The guy is not. The guy's a 33-year-old upstart jihadi whose fighting skills, not his family lineage, have catapulted him into being the most powerful member of the Masood tribe. A good friend of mine who comes from South Waziristan and whose uncle is actually one of these prominent tribal elders said that no one in Waziristan, South Waziristan right now, would dare speak against Baitullah Masood because they know, even his uncle, who is of a very prominent family, because they know that Baitullah Masood has said that, look, anyone, Baitullah Masood hasn't actually said it, but everyone knows that if you speak against him, that he has fleets of suicide bombers, and he'll just throw some 14-year-old kid with a bomb at you as you're, you know, meeting, and it's all over. What the army has done is the army has tried to blockade South Waziristan in the past few weeks and deny the transfer of supplies and food into South Waziristan. But the Masood people realize this is what's happening. I mean, they realize in the same way that the Cubans realize that Castro is not the one that's caused their blockade, it's the Americans. The South Waziristan's also the people of South Waziristan also realize that the army is the one that's enforced their blockade. So rather than their opinion of Baitullah Masood declining over the past several months, their image of Baitullah Masood has actually increased. The goal of these militants, of Baitullah Masood, of Maulana Fazlullah and Sawat, of Molvi Fakir and Bajur, is to recover what the Pashtuns think is rightfully theirs, that being the government of Afghanistan. They may have more immediate and attainable short-term goals, such as implementing Sharia, particularly in what was formerly the Malakand Division, which is now Sawat. But we've got to realize that their interpretation of Sharia includes the fact that jihad is compulsive upon all of these people. And so while, you know, let me just make a point of differentiation. There are a number of Pashtuns living in the tribal areas who would be very happy simply living under a Sharia-led government. But these militants who are saying that all we want to do is to implement Sharia, anyone who believes that's the limit of their ambitions, I think, is being somewhat naive with themselves. Maulana Fazlullah, when I spent a day in Maulana Fazlullah's camp last October and spoke with a number of people, Maulana Fazlullah included, and all of his lieutenants, not all of them were making trips to Afghanistan to fight, but a significant number of them were. I mean, they were enjoying the safe haven that they had developed in Swat. They wanted to live according to Sharia in Swat, but they also saw that their greater goal was, like I said, to get back what was theirs, and that being the government in Kabul. The situation in Afghanistan is particularly why no lasting peace is attainable, and that is that so long as there are American troops in Afghanistan, they are the oxygen to this jihadi movement, to this militancy movement, and to this insurgency along the border. Think about credibility right now of the militants. As these negotiations started up a few weeks ago, suddenly there was a car bombing in Mardan, a town a bit out of Peshawar, that killed three policemen. And the Taliban, although they had signed a ceasefire, and although they were engaged in peace dialogue, they said, "Yep, that was us." The government kind of looked at them and said, "Well, what do you mean? I thought we had a peace deal going." They said, "No, that was just us, you know, sort of taking out revenge because you had knocked off one of our guys a few weeks before the peace deal started." You got to be kidding me. I mean, a ceasefire is a ceasefire, is it not? And the Taliban are still saying, "Well, we've got some unfinished business that we need to take care of before the ceasefire is fully enacted." In the same way, yesterday or 2 days ago in Swat, there was a report as they're signing this deal in Swat. And one of the local government officials asked the militant spokesman, said, "Okay, so does this mean that if we agree to implement Sharia in Swat Valley, that you all will lay down your arms?" And the guy said, "Well, we don't have any arms." I mean, you've got to be kidding me. And the fact is that the government is trying, like Josh said, they're trying to go through this exercise to show the public that they're trying. And so, therefore, they're continuing along the negotiations, even though the militants who have been, you know, sending suicide bombers and ambushing convoys for the past 6 months are now telling them that we don't have any arms. I mean, so. The other issue is that the Taliban now What is their exit strategy? What would you feasibly be able to dangle in front of them that would be able to convince them to lay down their arms, to stop fighting, et cetera? And I want to just use the example of Abdul Rashid Ghazi, the former head of the Red Mosque. Ghazi was a very practical, witty political operator. He I love telling the story. Someone asked him last year at one point as they were arresting prostitutes, or they were arresting the owner of a brothel in Islamabad, whether his campaign against prostitution in Islamabad signaled the Talibanization of Islamabad. And his response was, well, when Rudy Giuliani became the mayor of New York, he also went after the brothels. Did anybody say that was the Talibanization of New York? Whether it was an apt analogy or not, nonetheless, you had to give the guy some credit for it. I mean, it was still a fairly witty response. So, and he saw himself very much as a historical character. He told me on numerous occasions that, look, if the government kills me, it's only going to expedite the Islamic revolution that I've kind of kickstarted. So he painted himself in this way. He painted himself in this way to his followers and to himself and to the press. So what happened is last July when this rebellion kicked off in the middle of the city, a French journalist called a friend of mine and said, he was in Paris, and he said, well, you know, what should I do? Should I come back? He was based in Islamabad. Should I come back? And our response was, well, do you consider Ghazi a jihadi or do you consider him a politician? And that was the kind, you know, was he going to go down in a ball of flames or is he going to negotiate his way out of this? I was fairly convinced that he was going to negotiate his way out. And yet what happened is that he had so convinced those around him that they were going to go down in sort of a ball of flames that Ghazi up until the very end was on the telephone talking to the local media, talking about negotiations. And then all of a sudden he stopped using the phone. And the perception was that he had surrounded himself with members of Jaish-e-Mohammed, Sabah Sahaba, the sort of hardest core of the hardcore. And they simply, you know, pointed a gun barrel in his waist and said, we're not talking our way out of this. This is, you know, like you've gotten us this far and we're going to go ahead and take the next step. So, and this same thing is happening right now in the tribal areas where there's always going to be someone younger, someone more radical, someone more committed who is not going to let their leaders punk out. And so you've got kind of a game of one-upsmanship. And this one-upsmanship is also taking the form of what has become a very vogue term is this takfirism, which is labeling kind of anyone who's not as extreme as you are a non-Muslim. So I'll wrap this up by just saying a word about the religious parties, those that formed the MMA and won the election in 2002. And everyone in Washington, not everyone, but a number of people in Washington were sort of freaking out that this was the vanguard of Talibanization in Pakistan. As Josh could well attest, you know, these parties, this was kind of misplaced hype. And these parties, in fact, showed a much more practical streak and pragmatic streak than many people believed. This is also precisely the reason why they lost credibility in these areas. The more that they showed their ability to be co-opted and their willingness to negotiate, the less and less people believed them. They lost whatever credibility they had in the minds of the Taliban because if the Taliban were fighting, the religious parties were playing politics. They lost whatever credibility they had in the mind of the average Islamist in the Northwest Frontier Province because they didn't deliver on their promises of Sharia. And they lost whatever credibility they had from ordinary Pashtun swing voters who eventually voted for the ANP because they had pitched themselves as being more honest, pitched themselves as being less corrupt, and then, frankly, they couldn't deliver much more than anti-American slogans. There was the head of JUI, which is one of the major component parties in the MMA, last year. I asked him, you know, he used to regard the Taliban as quote-unquote his boys, and I said to him, as the Taliban had just a few months earlier had shot some rockets at his house, I said, so, you know, do you still consider these guys your boys? And his response was that we don't agree with the Mujahideen's cause, but we differ over our priorities, that they prefer to fight, but I believe in politics. And the problem was that in the environment that was prevailing in the Northwest Frontier Province, that was simply not acceptable anymore. So, thanks.
Well, thank you both for, I think, some really good bringing so many good subtleties to this conversation, which clearly are needed here in Washington. Maybe if I could ask those of you who want to ask questions when you do to just identify yourselves, just your name and your organization, and then keep your questions as brief as this one will be. You have suggested that there's almost nobody that can be trusted. And that it's hard to imagine who could take firm action, who could be an effective enforcer if an agreement was ever reached. Maybe you could just speak to those two points. Are there some people you could trust? Because clearly the institutions of government are also don't have the public trust any more than some of the groups you were just describing.
Well, when I had started doing the reporting for the story that eventually led to my deportation, I was fairly convinced that Maulana Fazlur Rahman, who was the head of JUI, was kind of in some weird, perverted way the last great hope that the government had, in that he straddled this line between the government and between the militants. In the course of doing this, though, as someone said to me, that the militants thought that the militants think he's the government's man, and the governments think he's the militants' man. And in fact, he's no one's man. And so this is – I don't think that right now, unfortunately, I think the religious parties offer perhaps the best hope. But in this sort of leapfrogging amongst the militants, where whoever makes that first step to engage in sincere peace dialogue is going to be ostracized. Look at Maulana Sufi Muhammad, who was just about 3 weeks ago released from prison after 7 years of detention, after which in 2001 he had taken several thousand young madrasa students from the Swat Valley to Afghanistan, essentially came back with a few of them, and their parents all said, this isn't what we bargained for, what are you doing? And so the government eventually held him and detained him. So they kind of thought that, well, they'd be able to use Sufi Muhammad as a way. Sufi Muhammad is actually the father-in-law of Maulana Fazlullah. They thought they'd be able to use this connection and use his authority to talk down the militants and to be able to convince the militants in Swat to to come to some lasting treaty. And it didn't work. I mean, they now look at Sufi Muhammad as being kind of old and washed up. So I'm not overly optimistic at this point that there is someone who can negotiate and who can be that go-to man between these two factions.
I think Nick is largely right about that, particularly in some of the most problematic areas. But I think it's important to realize there's a real continuum here. All of these different groups that we refer to as the Taliban, because they decided it would be convenient for them to all refer to themselves as the Tehrik-e-Taliban in Pakistan. For example, in Sawat, I think that the situation is very different than it is in the Massoud strongholds of Waziristan. The Swat Valley has a long and storied history of having charismatic leaders rise up, find kind of a mainstream patron, do a little jihad against somebody who's nominally an outsider, and then after some time flame out. Because the people weren't so much into that kind of thing. Areas like Durrat Imkhail, south of Peshawar, which has seen a rise in militancy, a place that we've both been to, that's an area where I think the tribal leaders still have a great deal of authority and leverage. And you can see this in the way that the negotiations play out and the way that the government tries to bring tribal authority to bear on some of these new groups that are mostly rolling up from the south on their way up to Peshawar and have found a nice place to regroup. It's also where lots of guns are made. You can order any kind of gun you want there. So in that area, there is some kind of authority which can mitigate these problems. I think it comes through a more of a tribal channel. And then South Waziristan is a very, very different case, much more isolated, a very different history. And so I think that spectrum is important. The question of people you can trust is one that comes up a lot, and I always find interesting. People ask, for example, the U.S. is giving lots of funds to build up the Frontier Corps. The U.S. is giving them night vision goggles or this and that. Are these people who can be trusted? And I think the answer is, well, no, they can't be trusted. But I think that's not exactly the right question either. The question is not whether these people can be trusted. The question is whether there's some marginal utility to doing this in terms of either using them to combat some forms of militancy on the fringe, in terms of trying to create factions within different groups, all of the tools that have been at the disposal of administrators in these areas for centuries. And often there is some marginal utility. So I would agree that releasing Sufi Muhammad, who was the founder of the TNSM group up in Swat. He's an old man, and I really got a kick out of the news reports here that some Taliban leader had been released. The guy's an old man, and it's not going to change the hardcore folks who are in the SWAT Valley who were grew up with the TNSM and then became affiliated with the Taliban from Waziristan. It's not going to change their mind, but it does have the possibility of fragmenting some of those who are not at the very center of that organization. It has the possibility of shifting public opinion in these areas, which these groups do. At the end of the day, they need a measure of public opinion in order to survive. And when people say that, well, you know, Sufi Muhammad, we don't necessarily like him all that much, but if he's against this, you know, so there is some utility to these things, and I think that seen along a spectrum, in some of the areas, these government actions have a lot more efficacy than, for example, in Waziristan, where you could release a Sufi Muhammad-like figure and absolutely nothing would change.
Great. Thanks very much. I think Craig, and then Arno, then this gentleman, and then Ambassador Schaefer. I think that's... Hey, Craig, could I get you just to speak in the mic in case this is being recorded, so we'll have an audio. I'm sorry. Thanks.
If the de facto result of these peace deals is that attacks against Pakistanis are curtailed, but the jihad continues across the border and against the West, how do you think Kiani is likely to react? How is Zardari and Sharif likely to react?
Do you want to back up a few questions and mix them up?
As long as there are privileged sanctuaries for Taliban in Fatah, what are U.S. options in Afghanistan, and is there any hope of NATO prevailing in Afghanistan?
So much has been said about the new government in Pakistan, the elections and all that, and today... Secretary Boucher is speaking, testifying on the Hill also on this matter. People of Pakistan have worked very hard to bring democracy back in Pakistan, and everybody wants to succeed this. But many people, including Musharraf, may be not interested that democracy should is the best way for Pakistan. My question is that what advice do you have now for the United States that which maybe people of Pakistan think that they have failed in the past under Musharraf government, that how to continue the democracy in Pakistan. And you think this drama going on now, new drama, because some people think either Musharraf will stay or the new government will stay or both cannot stay.
I'm interested in your question, in your answer to Craig's question, but I'm struck by the fact that neither of you mentioned Balochistan. And it seems to me that this is a really important area, whether you're looking at internal insurgency in Pakistan and the threat it represents to the Pakistani state, or at the impact on Afghanistan. My working assumption is that there's a different dynamic in play in Balochistan, but I wonder if either of you is prepared to talk about it.
I know, but it's related. Thank you to both of you. Interesting presentations. Josh, maybe I didn't understand you correctly, but I think your recommendation was let the AMP play these negotiations out, but you didn't seem that you were optimistic that they would succeed. So why is that potentially a good strategy if they aren't going to succeed, and what's plan B if that doesn't work? And then, Nick, I guess I wanted to know a bit more about if the military is leading the negotiations in Fatah, the many ones that are happening probably behind the scenes. How optimistic are you that they can get anywhere? How involved are they with really what's going on? Those kinds of questions. Thanks.
Feel free to jump back and forth.
Yeah.
So take one or two.
Those are good questions. I think that the question about the difference between the response of militants in Pakistan and Afghanistan is a critical one. And Gilani's did an interesting bit of signaling in his first parliamentary speech, the new prime minister, when he basically signaled, I think it was his parliamentary speech or it might have been a subsequent interview, where he said that if it is the case that we have deals that are advantageous to us but not advantageous to Afghanistan, we're still going to consider that a problem. That was the politically shrewd thing for him to say, but I think that's probably highest on the list of U.S. concerns that, well, sure, you're just going to bump the problem across the border, and then it's not going to be much better. And again, I think seeing these different problems as somewhat different problems, which are connected, problems along a spectrum, that's certainly a real risk with Waziristan and with whatever happens with Baitullah Masood. I think it's somewhat less of a risk with Swat and Malakand, although in Bajor it's adjacent to Afghanistan, and it would be very easy to push some of those problems in that direction. When the government took action in Swat last November, a lot of the militants actually didn't go west toward Afghanistan. They went east deeper into Pakistan, which was an interesting phenomenon to watch. And I think that will be something worth watching, how those groups respond. But I think that really is the crux of it, that these the U.S. will be most concerned not if these deals just fail, but if they fail and displace. I think that's what we have to watch. Let me also ask.
I don't know why. I call it a gut instinct. I don't really have any hardcore insider knowledge about it, but I'm pretty convinced that the Pakistani government is playing a very savvy double game. It's telling the population that it's going to take a new approach to fighting the militants, but in the meantime, the predator flights. They may be curtailed to some extent, but they haven't cut them off. And I have a feeling that both Gilani and Kiani are kind of, after they make some public pronouncement, then going to the Americans and saying, you know, don't worry, we're not going to change that much. We're not going to change as much as we're promising the population. I think that Kiani's number one goal at this point is to take the army out of politics. I think that's kind of his overriding concern, is to get the army out of politics. Now, if that means taking them out of politics at the visible level, and so that the army is not the ones that are down in Wana signing the peace deals with Nek Mohammed, and rather that it's the ANP, then I think that whatever's on tape, I think that there's sort of what the cameras are showing is one side of the way that the government's proceeding, and what the cameras aren't showing is another side. And I don't think the off-camera has changed that much. But I think that it's a great question, and I'm not sure that I know the answer, or anyone does, as to how Kiani will respond if 6 months from now the Pakistani side of the border is quiet, but the Americans go to Kiani and say, you know, we've seen a 500% increase. You've got to do something. I don't know how Kiani will respond.
I would say also, just to build on that point, Aftab Sherpao, the former interior minister, made an interesting comment in the press a few days back when he was saying that there were negotiations going on between the imposition of the emergency in November and February, March, between the Pakistani military intelligence services and Baitullah and the militants in Waziristan. But that, at least in his telling of the story, when the civilian government kind of got briefed or heard about what had happened, the civilian government wanted it to be much more of a civilian-led sort of plan and sort of approach. Now, it's hard to, you know, there's so many different ways that could be played, but I think Nick is right that the army is interested, at least optically, in not being at the very forefront of this. I don't have that much to say about Balochistan because I think it is a very different issue, and I don't think that this coalition government has, at least as far as I've seen, made a lot of signals in a very substantive way in terms of addressing political concerns in Balochistan. But I think what Balochistan represents in a clear way is the Pakistani government's preeminent interest in helping the U.S. or appearing to help the U.S. when it comes to issues of al-Qaeda and foreign militants, and doing rather less when it comes to anything called the Taliban. I mean, I think anybody who would have gone to Quetta, I have not yet been there, would say that it's fairly obvious what's going on in Quetta, and that the Pakistani government is not doing very much about it. So I don't have anything more broadly to say about Balochistan, but Nick.
I mean, I think the Balochistan is, as you mentioned, I mean, it's 44% of the country, and yet it's a black hole in terms of news coverage, in terms of sort of all general analysis of what's happening in Pakistan. I think that the Taliban activity in Pakistan, from my impression, is that you have the flow of fighters is coming more from Fatah, and the flow of leadership is coming more from Quetta, in that numbers can more easily cross the rocky and hilly and really undemarcated border along the western edge of the tribal areas, whereas the border in Quetta, while, you know, vast and expansive and not overly well guarded, is still easier to patrol than the Fatah border is. And therefore, I think it's easier for there to be sort of a signal that, okay, the fourth car with license plate, blah, 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 close your eyes. Okay, there it goes, and it's back and forth. But I do think that, you know, you mentioned the insurgency and the sort of domestic aspect. I think that it's interesting, as Josh mentioned, that that's a very easy war for the army to fight. Because the Baluchi nationalists, the insurgents, have been painted as being anti-Pakistani. And therefore, to get your average captain sort of revved up to go down and fight the insurgents is much easier to convince him emotionally than it is to go fight the Pashtuns, who are just very conservative Muslims who are trying to actually fight, you know, the infidel Americans across the border. But we do see that they just released the leader of the Baluchistan National Party, Akhtar Mengel, after 2 years in prison. So I think that's also a positive overture.
Let me ask the question, your question about failed negotiations. And I think you didn't hear me right, that I think that they're useful even though in some cases they're bound to fail. In other cases, I think they're, like I said, in SWAT, I'm a little bit more optimistic that they could actually move the ball forward. And that is because, and I'll try to explain this, I think having spent time in the frontier, the Pashtun mentality, the Pashtun norms that relate to the state's taking action against its own people and state engagement are such that the government can't take the kind of precipitous action that we would perhaps like the government to take. People think that it's just quite unjust for the government to go in and use force if it hasn't gone through a process of sitting down, jirga-like, negotiations being made, negotiations being broken, some kind of exchange. And often when you sit down and you have some kind of exchange based on fault, you know, often both parties give up something, even though, you know, one was, the preponderance of fault was on one party. So there are all kinds of these patterns of negotiation and patterns of discourse that are just very different. And so by going through this process, even though you know that it's not going to work out so well in the really difficult places, it does shape public opinion and in a positive way. And I think it gives the government the credibility to take the more kinetic actions that eventually it would have to take. In SWAT, the quote-unquote easiest case, they've negotiated some peace deals, as Nicholas said. They don't look particularly promising when they go, we don't have any arms with us, you know, and when they insist on still being able to use their FM radio and all of that entails. Having negotiated the agreement, I think it will be useful for the government because it will enable the government and the police forces, kind of the first level responders, the government, the police forces, and then up to the paramilitary, to be able to respond and garner public opinion and public support for responding because they have seen what was tried and what was failed. Now that becomes a less convincing argument. I say as a constructivist, reflexively back to myself, a less convincing argument if you're looking at Dar al-Khail, where the government's writ is much weaker. It's a provincial tribal area. It's an area where the community of elders really has the most influence. And it applies less, or it applies at a much more kind of 30,000-foot level when you're looking at Baitullah Masood. In these kind of situations, there the drama is being presented to the Pakistani public at large and not to the Masoods as such. And there you could say that the utility is a lot less for having a failed negotiation as such.
I think that we must be winding down. I see you looking at the...
Okay. I just wanted to check and see.
Okay. I want to talk about the option, NATO and American options from the Afghanistan side. I found it really interesting. Last August, sitting there in Islamabad one day, Barack Obama had suddenly said that if he knew that there were Al-Qaeda safe houses or training camps in the tribal areas and he became president, he would bomb the tribal areas. All of a sudden, I had so many people coming up to me with the newspaper saying, who is Barack Obama? This guy, I mean, Barack Obama was suddenly a superstar. Well, not a superstar in a negative way, but everyone knew Barack Obama suddenly overnight. Now, but we also found it very interesting that after the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, up until the time that this new government in Islamabad actually took power, there was a barrage of predator strikes that whether they were being launched from the Pakistani side, whether the predators were taking off from the Pakistan side of the border or from the Afghanistan side of the border, there was certainly a concern amongst the agency, amongst the American intelligence, that this access was going to dry up with the new government. But someone had to also be giving them the green light. And what we saw was that the intelligence itself was so unbelievably better. There were an average of one strike every 2 weeks. There were no mass casualties, unlike in Bajor and unlike in North Waziristan in the past, where we went to kill, you know, one Arab and ended up killing 40 Pashtuns. That just creates – rather than eliminating one enemy, you've just created 1,000 new ones. And so with these strikes, they were extremely precise. They were, you know, there was one that hit Sirajuddin Haqqani's compound in North Waziristan, killed a number of Arabs, a couple of Uzbeks, a couple of, they said, Turkmens. I still don't understand where the Turkmens came into this. the precision, no one really made a big fuss out of them. The tribals don't really care. The tribals don't mind that much that we're simply knocking off foreigners, or at least they're not making a big deal about it. The government didn't care enough to raise it and make a big issue about it. And so I think that someone had to be informing, someone had to be saying, look, at that house tomorrow night at 8 p.m., there's going to be a meeting of some foreign guys. You should hit that house. So that also lets me know that either we're paying a lot more money to those people that are informing in the tribal areas, or that there is the public sentiment is turning a little bit. And I think that in some ways bodes well. I don't know what has changed all that much on the ground, but it kind of gave a little bit of optimism. Not necessarily that predator strikes are the answer to all of this, but that public support turning against the foreigners is part of the answer to this.
Let me just jump in there a little quickly, just because we heard something similar to that, that in fact people we heard that the most recent drone strikes seemed to be hitting sort of more desirable targets, at least in terms of the Pashtun people that we were talking to, in particular in Peshawar. And when we got to Quetta, we also heard that the Taliban leadership that used to have more of a profile in Quetta was being more private in their movement now, which also suggested maybe the same sort of thing. So on the other hand, we really continue to have a feeling that most of the people we talk to, when they go into those areas, they go with 30 guns. So the movement is very, very limited. The knowledge is extremely superficial. And I would say a fundamental question for almost anybody who is making these choices is how many sources do you have? How many cross sources do you have? How many cross sources do you have? And that would be what I would be asking if I was sitting in the National Security Council, because I would guess that it's still very thin, but maybe qualitatively better than it has been.
And of course, every time you double check, that takes more time. And so if you know the tall Arab with the long beard, you know, all of a sudden is wandering in house number, you know, this house on this street, and one guy calls in and says, you know, he's there right now. Then if you're waiting for three or four other sources to make sure that you don't kill 40 you know, Masouds from South Waziristan, it is. And so, you know, you're right. It's the problems are manifold.
And I'm not convinced that it has to be for reviewing every strike, but it's just for knowing that what you have on the ground and how rich the database is, so that when you do make a decision, you have the feeling that actually it's rather well grounded. Which I think that's probably the missing ingredients, though. Go ahead. Did you want to take the democracy question, or should we move to another round?
I think we can move on.
Okay. I think Jerry and then anybody else? Any other hands up? Yes. Okay, you'll go third. Thanks.
I'm not sure there was so much difference between you at one level, but then I'd like to push you a little bit if I could. If I understood Josh saying it probably won't be real. You don't have to worry about it because probably not going to work anyway, but it's a good way to get people on your side because that's what you need to show good faith. But I don't think he disagrees with you that it's not going to work very well. So it seems to me there's not so much difference between you. But then I guess the question is, okay, so what happens next? I mean, what's plan B, so to speak? It doesn't work. You get these guys running around. They're thugs, terrorists, et cetera, within their own context. I don't mean with respect to Afghanistan or something. So what are the options for the government, number one? And number two, does the population ever turn enough against the thuggery to allow the government to get a foothold to say, well, if you guys want to live under a bunch of thugs who come in with these guns and beat you up all the time, no matter who you have as your leader, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, but we're here to help if you don't want that. Is there a tipping point at which that, because that seems to me to be the key to us, any kind of plan B that the government might have, is that people say, well, we don't want Batula Masud to be the paradigm of how we're going to live for the next four generations.
I'll start. I would say that, you know, I'm not just entirely a cheerful fatalist about this. I think that these programs by the government do have a chance of doing something substantive in SWAT, for example. It might not be our first best solution or their first best solution, but the government has rolled out a new Sharia regulation, which was originally put in place in the 1990s, or it's a slightly revised version of that regulation. As part of their negotiations, it's mostly a gloss. It allows the district judicial official to be called a qazi, an Islamic judge, and then it allows a religious figure to advise the qazi about matters, and it tries to speed up the adjudication of justice. Not a first best solution in my mind, but also not a bad solution for appeasing quite a number of people. Is it going to work for, you know, forever? Certainly not. But it did a decent job from the 1990s. Again, not as a first best solution, but as something which was able to appeal to some people's kind of feelings that they wanted something that was more like the Sharia. And the government did it mostly in name only. And it was a contributing factor to negotiations and to being able to buy off enough people. Again, not to beat the dead horse, but there is a continuum in terms of what a plan B looks like, or even in terms of what the plan A looks like. In the SWAT Valley, the plan B, if the negotiations don't work perfectly, and of course they're not going to, is to develop a really effective counterinsurgency response to groups like the TNSM / Tehrik-e Taliban based on effective local governance, use of the police forces, and then have the government be able to kind of escalate till it gets to paramilitary and then eventually military. The government's response in SWAT, you know, for example, back in November, didn't exhibit that kind of nuance. They went from doing nothing for quite some time to bringing in helicopter gunships, which is quite a gap between nothing and helicopter gunships. And there's a lot of room in there for the government, which is widely liked and widely considered to be legitimate in these areas, to be able to develop what we would consider a counterinsurgency response, that is, a contestation over political legitimacy that involves the public at large. So that would be kind of plan A and plan B in SWAT, and negotiations could very much contribute to that. Whether they succeed or only succeed in part. In places like Deir al-Mukhail, that is still somewhat applicable, but less so, because in those areas, the government's ability to kind of contest for political legitimacy is limited by the fact that there's not a government as such. And in those cases, you have a political agent, and you can try to bring some of the people on your side, and public opinion does matter, because it's a jirga-oriented kind of mode of governance. But the plan B would be to escalate using those tribal leaders and then eventually bring in some outsiders. In a place like the Masud areas of Waziristan, there is really no government there to contest. And so therefore, plan B, if these things don't work, is inevitably, in the short term, going to be much more kinetic. It's going to be, you know, what kinds of government, military or paramilitary operations can one conduct and do it in a way that has as little blowback as possible and as little as possible damages the kind of pool of legitimacy that the government has built up through its process of negotiations. And so I don't know if that makes sense to you, but I think there really is this continuum based in some part on kind of the thickness of the government institutions and history in those areas as to what their fallback response looks like.
Yeah, I'll talk a little bit about the tipping point that you asked about. I think that wasn't there a book that someone recently wrote about that a couple years ago? We could send that guy to Pakistan and see what he comes up with. I think that it has to get worse before it gets better, unfortunately. I think that, you know, the Taliban, in that right now, as people getting back to this notion that the Pakistani people don't see this as being their war, they see this as being America's war that spilled over the borders, whatnot. Unfortunately, more people in Lahore whose wives were simply going to the market one day to buy vegetables, for that public opinion to really turn, there have to be more collateral damage. There need to be more casualties for people to begin saying, you know, my second cousin was killed yesterday in a bomb in the market. This is not right. Then you're going to start seeing this turn. At this point, it seemed as though it was starting to tilt that way in the run-up to the elections, and then since then there's been something like a sort of fragile peace has prevailed. And the Taliban seem to have been reading from the same counterinsurgency guidebook that we do. And they almost kind of preempted any sort of Anbar awakening, attempts to implement an Anbar awakening type of solution in the tribal areas by, over the past several years, just systematically knocking off all of these mullahs who could potentially have been used to push the Taliban out. In late February, there was a meeting, a jirga held in Deir Adam Khail, in which 40 tribal elders had just drafted a decision that they were going to begin burning the homes of local people who held and local people whose sons were fighting with the Taliban and local people who were harboring militants. They had just drafted this. They were going to begin deciding about how to actually implement it, and some kid ran into the crowd and pulled the cord, blew himself up, and killed 40 of these tribal elders. So, like I said, it almost seems like there has to be more of that for these Pashtuns to finally say, okay, enough is enough. Again, though, that's simply kind of inviting some sort of civil war scenario. That's not exactly inviting any kind of lasting peace. I'm, as you can see, kind of overall skeptical about a lasting peace, about the Taliban settling for something. But this infighting, even the infighting amongst the Taliban has increased in the past few weeks. There was this one militant in the Khyber Agency who had set up this organization that the Arabic, or the English translation of the Arabic phrase is the Department of Promotion, or Department for the Promotion of Virtue and Prevention of Vice. His name was Haji Namdar, and he had spoken out very openly against the presence of militants. And then Betul Masood dispatched one of these young suicide bombers and hit his madrasa a few weeks ago and wounded about 15, 20 people. So this infighting almost seems to be – is kind of a necessary evil towards actually turning the public perception against them and kind of leaning that tipping point in the opposite way.
I think we have about four more questions, and so we'll probably just – take the four questions and then give our speakers a chance to just wrap up. So why don't we make them as brief as we can, please.
Garland Bhatta, Foreign Policy Association.
Can you push your... Yeah, thanks.
Oh, sorry.
One more time.
Needs to be read.
Garland Bhatta, Foreign Policy Association.
One more time.
There you go.
Yeah, we heard you. What's that?
Go ahead.
There had been radical differences between Karzai's government as Musharraf's government at that time, maybe personal differences, on operation and borders, Afghan-Pakistan border, and as well as the intelligence. Now, the same differences had been possibly, and the matter of fact, had been held in abeyance with all these happenings in Pakistan, turmoil in Pakistan. How have those differences been sorted out with the new government in Pakistan between Karzai, and what is the, you know, relationship between the two, as it did not really end with Musharraf very well?
My question concerns urban terrorism and its relationship in several respects to what's happening in some of the frontier areas. I'm Polly Nayak. I'm an independent consultant. Forgot to say that. I wondered, first of all, how you see this growing urban terrorism tying into the militant agenda. I think Nick already pointed to one of the potential outcomes, which is that you may get more people upset and perhaps opposing the militancy because of the scale of urban collateral damage potential. But I wondered what you see as the main intention and how you think the militants calculate the effect. And second, what are your perceptions of the competence of the local authorities to deal with urban terrorism, urban attacks?
Turn off your microphone so you can finish that.
I'm Ann Hudak from DAI, and we're implementing the Fatah capacity building program. So I just want to thank you both for such an interesting presentation. I hope your analysis can filter out very broadly because it's such a wealth of information that you have. Just very quickly, I wanted to see, you know, if you could comment a bit on the political legitimacy of the Fatah Secretariat. And in particular, I'd be very interested to hear if there's any, if this is woefully naive or if there's any reason to hope that sound development objectives coming out of the agency plans, which are due at the end of this month, if that could be the kind of tipping point that Jerry's talking about. I noticed, I was very happy to see in the research report, the TRIP report, this emphasis on the strategic communications capacity, and that's something that we've been very much focused on, admittedly with very little success, and I think that is the right button to push in many ways. Water is another area where, understandably, but also very difficult, that people, you know, have kind of coalesced around and that there may be some sort of, again, tipping point that could be seen there. But is your sense that there's just no legitimacy there and that that's not realistic, or is there something here that can be looked at in a little bit more depth? I say hopefully as we manage this project.
Tazia, I think you have the last question. Tazia Schaefer. I love, Nick, your emphasis on policing, but what worries me desperately is that that is probably the least competent part of governance in Pakistan. It's, you know, beyond the technical problems, there's just a fundamental mismatch between what the banana-eating public would be willing to work with on the part of a police officer and what the police officers think they're entitled to. Mm. The America's war problem is very much on point, but my impression from being in Pakistan right after the election is that when people talk about America's war, they're talking primarily about the Afghan-related parts of it, and that the Pakistanis have been fed to the teeth with suicide bombings inside of Pakistan. The lull that took place, not right away, but after about the third week in March, undoubtedly had a lot of people concluding that the government was onto something. That's the good news. The bad news is that if the Pakistan government can find a formula for reducing suicide bombing inside Pakistan, and I'm talking mostly about inside the settled areas. I mean, your different places track pretty well with how settled, quote-unquote, the area are, that they would grab that in a heartbeat without ever telling the U.S. that they weren't worried about the Afghan part, but that's definitely right, where their priority is. The other bad news is that this relative success in cutting at least way down on suicide bombings may retard the tipping point.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay, gentlemen, you've got about 5 to 7 minutes. Thank you,
I, your question about development. I guess my question. My question to USAID, you're speaking about the $750 million project, right? Is just who in Fatah are you going to hand the money over to? When I met people at the State Department a few weeks ago, they were fairly confident, and they admitted that it may be somewhat naively confident, but that they had a pretty good office in Peshawar with some people they trusted. That's great. But are those people trusted in the tribal areas? They may be from the tribal areas. They may be upstanding citizens. But there's a lot of money that's going to go in there, and my kind of rhetorical question is, you know, how many guns can you buy for $750 million? I know they're not going to put money in there per se, but even development projects are going to be met with a great amount there's a credibility gap there. I mean, let's look at the anti-polio vaccination drive last spring. That was, they didn't even try it in South Waziristan, but it was attempted in Bajor and in Swat, and Mulvi Fakir Muhammad and Malana Fazlullah both got on their FM radio stations and said that this is actually an anti-Islamic impotency serum, that if you give this to your children, they will never be able to have children, and this is an attempt to wipe out the Muslim population. You know what? No one took the immunization. So, I mean, I would hope that And I, meeting people like yourself, I know that there are very smart people in USAID that have thought this through and that have kind of thought about back channels. But I just, the hold that the militants have on these areas is such where you can't really go in there and do business, particularly in North and South Waziristan, where I know that's the goal, that's where they want it most, and yet you can't even get in there and think about doing anything without the Taliban's approval. Even in Mohmand Agency, about 2 weeks ago, there were some incredibly disturbing pictures where the Taliban in Mohmand had arrested a couple of people for kidnapping, and there was a picture in which they had wrapped a guy's face in a scarf and shot him in the face from point blank, and that was his punishment. And then they, you know, cut his head off, and a bunch of people stood around cheering. I mean, this is justice. This is authority. These are the people who are kind of making the decisions as to who goes up and down the roads right now in those areas. So there's a serious problem there. And I agree with you totally. After I was in Balochistan in October of 06, I came back, I had been there for about 2 or 3 weeks, and the ISI was stopping by the house on a regular basis. And so I went to the U.S. Embassy and said, look, I just want you to know that, you know, if I disappear, the ISI are coming by every day asking where I am. And so we met with the head security officer there, and the press attaché said you should meet with him and just kind of tell him your problems. So I met with this guy, and I said, so who do you deal with? And he said, oh, I deal very much with the Islamabad police chief. And I thought, I can't believe I'm going to waste my time talking to them. I mean, they have no impact or effect on you know, ground level security. And that's the contact of the head U.S. security person is the Islamabad police. And I do agree with you that the lack of bombings certainly does retard this tipping point. So I'll let Josh take the other question.
Thanks. To the Karzai Musharraf question, I think it's kind of a notable issue almost by its absence on an official plane. I mean, has anybody heard about the trilateral coordinating mechanism or these kind of things recently? I haven't. I think that some of that is because of the political changes in Pakistan, the fact that Musharraf has been has kind of moved into the background to watch how things play out. And so the personal aspect of that relationship doesn't come to the forefront as much. But I don't get the sense that there's very much substantively happening in terms of coordination. And if you ask about the trilateral mechanism here in Washington, people say, you got to ask NATO about that. Why don't you go talk to NATO about that? So I don't get the sense that there's been much on that front, which is a problem, of course. I want to maybe combine the question about urban terrorism and policing, because I think that they are related. Calculating the competence of local authorities in the frontier areas, the police have been completely overwhelmed by what has come their way with suicide bombings, with targeted killings. They have an incredible backlog in the settled areas, for example, just of high-profile, politically important cases that they're trying to get through, never mind all of the other ones. I don't think there's been a single successful use of DNA technology to identify any suicide bomber in Pakistan, at least for quite a long time, which, of course, is difficult with suicide bombers, but there's a real lack of capacity there. I'm not wildly optimistic that better policing would have a dramatic effect on those kind of challenges. But I do think, in the context of urban terrorism, again, from a counterinsurgency frame, police and local government are a first line of defense, and they're a first line of getting information into the system, moving things up the chain, deciding on responses. And particularly since the local government reforms of 2002 in Pakistan, which completely reshaped the nature of local governance in these areas, it's been much more difficult for the police to put forward even a fairly modest response when the young guys in the Toyotas with the Kalashnikovs come rolling in into town. And we've seen that over and over. The police used to report to a deputy commissioner in the area who could act very decisively, and now what happens is that the equivalent of the deputy commissioner in this system has very little little direct authority over the police. The police have become more politicized. The police refer something through the deputy commissioner to Peshawar. It goes to two committees, and then it goes back down the chain, and it usually takes about a week. And in such a circumstance, even though the police are not going to be an incredibly effective first line of defense, there's not a coordinated system of local government to respond to say, you know, what happens in the first 24, 48, and 72 hours when the guys in the Toyotas roll into a village? How does the government marshal all of the resources of the state to deal with that in a competent way? And which, of course, in urban areas is even more important because it tends to be much more concentrated. The question about the FATA Secretariat is interesting. I don't think that the FATA Secretariat as such has political legitimacy outside of elite circles. I mean, there's certainly a lot of competence there. I found it to be a very, very conservative institution in many ways. Being a political agent is a great gig if you can get it, because historically the government would give you lots of cash and you would go down and do what needed to be done to stabilize the situation. It's not a bad job to have from the cash perspective. And so when you talk to folks from the FATA Secretariat, they're very conservative in saying, well, if you make any changes to the structure of governance, you know, the whole thing's going to fall apart. So I found them to be conservative in that way. I don't think that they particularly have legitimacy as such. And I think people in the FATA, when they're dealing with their political agent, they don't see them as a representative of the FATA Secretariat. They see them as a representative of the governor, who's a representative of the president. They see that chain of command in a different kind of way. But the tipping point is a critical issue, and I agree that urban terrorism does move you toward a tipping point because it changes attitudes. And I was there last summer when all kinds of stuff was happening in the wake of the Red Mosque, and there were bombs in Lahore and places like this, and that really affected the psyche of the Pakistani on the street. That things were happening on Mall Road in Lahore, Karachi. Well, things go haywire in Karachi every few years, but Mall Road in Lahore, that's like the mall in Washington. That had a big psychological impact. So those kind of things do on the negative side. And on the positive side, the development work and the getting the message out, I think it does make a difference. Sometimes more on the margins, these groups are often deeply unpopular when they come into a place. Now, in the mountains of Waziristan among the Mesuds, it's a somewhat different story. But the further you get on this continuum toward settled governance, I've been in these places. People like the idea of Talibanism because it kind of represents something righteous and good. They don't like the Taliban when they come into their village because these guys are nasty. They kill people. They close barbershops. They close music stores, curfews. I mean, it's really a mess. Very few people want the Taliban to come to their village. And so in terms of popular sentiment, there is a lot that can be done to move people away from that because they really don't like a lot of these groups in the first place. They like what they represent, opposition to the hegemonic West or a vague idea of Sharia, but they don't like them so much in reality.
Great, thank you. Yeah. Please join me in thanking Josh and Nick for their excellent presentations. Really very well done.